This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Find out what's new.
Chemistry.
Evolution.
Information technology.
Cosmology.
Mathematics. Ecology.
Oceanography.
Planetary science.
Medicine.
Biotechnology.
Astronomy.
Welcome to the February 24th edition of SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine, and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on SciPod, big trouble in the late Triassic. Scientists puzzle over an event that may have helped out the dinosaurs, but left not a single long-legged crocodile standing. Zoom with a view, building a telescope that can see mountains, forests, and oceans on another world. And from Greenland to gladiators to a snail with an iron shoe, we'll step up to this week's science news. But first, thanks to Jurassic Park, we all have a vivid image in mind of what the world may have been like when dinosaurs ruled the Earth. But have you ever wondered who or what put the dinosaurs in charge in the first place? Paul Olson has some thoughts about that. He's a professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory in New York, part of Columbia University. And he's studying the Triassic. Now, just in case you don't have an eight-year-old around to remind you, the Triassic came before the Jurassic. And as New Scientist Ivan Semenek found out, it was a very, very strange time.
Dr. Olson, can you take us back on a safari to the late Triassic? What kind of animals would we see if we could be there now?
Well, we've just learned this within the last few years, but the surprising thing is that there were lots of different kinds of animals around that we had no idea of before. First of all, there were large numbers of various shaped beasts, reptiles, that were more closely related to crocodilians than they were to dinosaurs. These animals would vary in size from quite small, less than a meter, to 5 meters or so in length. Some of them were carnivores, some of them were herbivores. Although they were related to crocodilians, they had very, very long legs and were fully terrestrial. So we wouldn't have recognized them immediately as crocodilian forms, even though that's where their ancestry lay.
And apart from those crocodilians, what else might we find there? How common were dinosaurs, for example?
Tolerably common. The herbivores were common in the higher latitudes. We don't know about them in the central latitudes, in the more tropical latitudes, but we do know that there was this marvelous diversity of creatures, including forms that were unrelated to any reptiles that are alive today, things that had huge heads with extremely large fangs, snake-like bodies, maybe a meter or so in length, with tiny little legs, completely covered in armor, must have been terribly biting little creatures. There were modern types of creatures around, such as frogs, and salamanders and turtles. Mammals had evolved, but they were all very small. So if you were there and walking around, there would be a very large number of very foreign-looking animals, in addition to primitive members of things you would recognize, like small dinosaurs.
Well, it sounds really different from the Jurassic, which came right after. So how much of a surprise is this to paleontologists?
It used to be, until quite recently, that we thought that the Triassic was a time that was sort of intermediate between the Paleozoic and the rest of the Mesozoic. So we expected to see small dinosaurs. We expected to see intermediate forms. What we didn't expect is what really seems to be the case, and that is that the late Triassic was a fully developed, relatively mature ecosystem with a great many creatures that were unique to that time period and did not make it into the Jurassic. So it really wasn't an intermediate time. It was a time unto itself.
And then something happened that changed everything.
Yes, we have no real complete understanding of what happened that changed the world. Clearly something decimated the biodiversity. This is true in plants as well as animals. At least 50% of all terrestrial families of reptiles were wiped out, and apparently in a relatively brief period of time. Included among these were all of these strange forms that were unique to the Triassic.
So are there any clues to what might have precipitated that sudden change?
The most important clue is seen in the flora. The flora based on fossil pollen and spores, which rather surprisingly preserve beautifully in rocks, they show an extremely abrupt transition occurring in less than 10,000 years. That change involves an enormous drop in diversity. Something like, again, like the animals, about 50% of all the forms disappear, and the flora goes from this relatively diverse tropical assemblage of lots of different kinds of seed plants and ferns to an extremely monotonous assemblage of conifers, where the pollen consists of something like 99.9% of one single species of pollen. So that's a very, very abrupt floral transition. Right at the transition, there's a layer that's found in several places which has unusual amounts of the element iridium. Now, that element is very rare in the Earth's crust, but it's relatively more common deep within the Earth's interior and in extraterrestrial material. So we find that in surprising abundance at exactly the place that the pollen and spores change.
Now, people who follow this field would recognize iridium because enriched levels of iridium are associated with impacts from asteroids or comets. So does that suggest that this is another one of those mass extinctions brought about by an impact from space?
Well, it certainly does to me. That's been my favorite theory, that just like at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary when the non-bird dinosaurs were wiped out, this iridium anomaly would be caused by another extraterrestrial impact. However, the magnitude of the iridium anomaly is much less than that at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, although it is within the range of some other known extraterrestrial impact debris. On the other hand, we know that some basaltic volcanic ashes can have similar amounts of iridium in them because they come from deep within the Earth, where iridium is relatively higher. And it could be that this iridium is from a volcanic event. That is what is favored by the majority of scientists. I'm quite in the minority in favoring an asteroid impact. At the present time, we cannot tell which of these two hypotheses is correct because sufficient geochemistry has not been done to be able to distinguish between the two hypotheses. In addition, we know that above the Triassic-Jurassic boundary, slightly after the Triassic-Jurassic boundary, was say within 20,000 years, there were massive outpourings of lava. The so-called Central Atlantic Magmatic Province, which is the Earth's largest terrestrial flood basalt province. It goes from central France all the way down to southwestern Brazil, 6,000 kilometers long, 1,500 kilometers wide, an enormous area covered with lava. And so people have naturally pointed to that as a possible origin of these extinctions.
So there are a couple of possible scenarios here, one involving an impact, another a major volcanic episode. Based on your description of the change in vegetation, it seems like life on Earth took a real hit, and very quickly. So what effect does all of this have on the dinosaurs?
We can see that prior to the Triassic-Jurassic boundary, had this very large, diverse suite of non-dinosaurs around. Dinosaurs were there. They were becoming more abundant through the Triassic, and they were becoming larger. But they were certainly not dominant. After the Triassic-Jurassic boundary, biodiversity has dropped tremendously. And dinosaurs and relatively more modern types of crocodile relatives are the main survivors, along with mammals, salamanders, turtles, and frogs, and so forth. So once we get over the boundary, we're essentially in a world populated by creatures which are still around now. Dinosaurs as birds, of course. Mammals survive. And that really is the entry point into the modern world. Furthermore, just as you get into the Jurassic, the size of the larger theropod dinosaurs increases dramatically. So the mass of these animals, the larger size of the larger individuals, doubled, which is a very significant ecological change. So once you get into the Jurassic, for the first time, you are really in the age of dinosaurs, where they are ecologically dominant. And of course, they last until 65 million years ago, when you have the next great mass extinction, and the only dinosaurs that survive after that point are birds.
You know, the more we learn about these mass extinctions, it's very striking, isn't it, how you see the biology of Earth creating these diverse, specialized, and in some cases very large creatures, And when a mass extinction occurs, it seems that these dominant species are the ones that disappear, as though the table's being cleared for the next round. Do you think that's suggestive of a larger pattern? And what do you think that's telling us about how life operates?
I think it is suggestive of a larger pattern. The larger pattern, basically, is that when life is going on normally, you have typical Darwinian adaptation to the environment. And you have increases in diversity through time as creatures become more fitted to the environment and to each other, and that diversity builds upon itself. But organisms adapt to the local conditions and times. They don't adapt to an anticipation of something that's some catastrophe that'll happen in the future. There's no way to adapt to that. So what survives these catastrophes, whether they're caused by asteroid impacts or they're caused by lava flows, is probably more or less chance. What they're doing exactly at the time, what their sizes are. You know, when we talk about ecologically dominant, we're usually talking about size. What would you see around if you were walking? What would be the obvious creatures? What would be the animals, the keystone species that are altering the landscape? And those tend to be large. And in enormous circumstances, that large size confers an ecological advantage and a stability, both in because of mass and because you can protect yourself. But when things get very, very bad, when the food source becomes rare, very rare, or even non-existent, those large animals are the very first to suffer. They are the most vulnerable ones. So it's not really surprising that the very obvious things should change, the things that we like to think of as ecologically dominant. So T. rex dies out at the end of the Cretaceous periods, but small birds survive.
And then along come humans. Dr. Olson, thanks very much for shedding some light on a poorly understood and perhaps underappreciated chapter in the history of life on Earth. It's really been a fascinating journey.
Thank you.
Dr. Paul Olson spoke to us from Palisades, New York, a place that is notably free of long-legged crocodiles. But if you're hungry for more information about the late Triassic and the mysterious extinction that brought it all to a close, well, you can read all about it in this week's edition of New Scientist magazine.
SciPod, an audio service of New Scientist magazine.
Now, here's Donna Page and Jeffrey Whittle with this week's science news.
Every 40 hours, the Greenland ice sheet loses the equivalent of a cubic kilometer of water, the same amount of water the city of Los Angeles consumes in 1 year. That's the startling result from the most detailed study yet of the world's second largest ice sheet. The study, led by researchers at the California Institute of Technology, also found that Greenland is losing its ice at more than twice the rate it was a decade ago. The loss of ice is particularly apparent at the southern end of Greenland, where warming Arctic water is seeping into crevices and accelerating the discharge of icebergs into the North Atlantic. Scientists warn that the impact of global warming on the Greenland ice sheet will probably lead to a greater and faster sea level rise than previously predicted. Donna?
Leaving DNA evidence at the scene of a crime could be tantamount to leaving a name tag. So say the researchers at the University of Leicester, who looked at the relationship between DNA and male surnames. They analyzed the Y chromosomes of 150 pairs of men who shared the same surname but were not knowingly related. Just like surnames, Y chromosomes are passed directly from father to son. The researchers found that about a quarter of the men were genetically linked, which means they shared a common ancestor more recently than 1300 AD, when surnames were first used in Britain. The study suggests that in the future, DNA evidence from a crime scene could be matched to the profile of a surname, even if the culprit's DNA has never been recorded. Jeff?
The spectacle of gladiators locked in mortal combat may remind us of the brutality of the ancient Roman world, but a new forensic analysis of gladiator skeletons shows that at least they played by the rules. A team of Austrian researchers looked at the remains of 67 individuals from a gladiator cemetery in the ancient Roman city of Ephesus in western Turkey. Injuries to the front of each skull suggest that the opponents the gladiators faced used just one weapon per bout of face-to-face combat. Likewise, the lack of multiple injuries and mutilation shows the gladiators practiced a strict adherence to the rules when facing each other in the arena. The team discovered that 10 of the gladiators died of a hammer-like blow to the side of the head, probably inflicted after the fight by a backstage executioner. As barbaric as all of this sounds, the findings show that gladiatorial combat was a far cry from the gory free-for-all sometimes depicted in Hollywood films and video games.
And finally, American and Japanese scientists have discovered perhaps the most bizarre footwear ever seen in the animal kingdom. It belongs to a species of snail that lives around the deep sea vents of the Indian Ocean. The snail grows a covering of iron sulfide scales over its foot. The scales are magnetized, but researchers don't think the snails are making use of their magnetic properties. Instead, the production of the scales offers a convenient way for snails to purge their bodies of toxic sulfides, which are emitted in high concentration by deep sea vents. Scientists think that over time, these mineral excretions evolved into a coat of armor that also provides protection from predators.
We hope you're enjoying this edition of SciPod, and we would love to know what you think of our podcast. If you'd like to share your thoughts with us, please complete our short podcast survey. It's easy. Just visit newscientist.com/podcast and follow the links to get the survey. And now back to our show. Have you ever had the sense you're being watched? Well, if Antoine Labrarie gets his way, the entire galaxy could soon be feeling that way. Dr. Labrarie is a professor of astronomy at the Collège de France, and his dream is a telescope that's so big it could show him what no other one has seen before. Other worlds, perhaps just like Earth, with oceans and continents, and possibly with life. We caught up with Dr. Labrarie at the Callern Observatory in the French Alps.
Dr. Labrarie, we can all picture those wonderful views of planet Earth as seen from the Apollo spacecraft. What kind of telescope would we need to see a planet like Earth in another solar system?
Well, it takes a moderately large telescope to actually see it as a small, unresolved point near its parent star. But if you want to see any detail on it, like continents, then it takes a much larger system with a mirror that would be something like 100 kilometers wide. Now, of course, you cannot build it as a single piece of glass, but you can build it as a dilute mosaic of little mirrors. That could be, say, 3 meters in size. And if you've got, say, 100 of these, then you, in principle, you can get a direct image that will show you continents of an exo-Earth, that is, an Earth-like planet that would be, for example, 10 light years away.
That would seem like quite a feat. Can you explain the terminology you used? What makes it a dilute mirror telescope?
Well, the currently existing large telescopes, the largest ones, like the Keck telescope in Hawaii, have a mosaic mirror, which means it is a large mirror which is made of smaller mirrors in mosaic fashion, okay? Now, in principle, you could build a dilute mosaic, that is a mosaic where the elements are very much are spaced away from each other a long distance. Of course, it would be better if you could have a complete mosaic, completely filled, but it would be much more expensive. So if you're going to build a 100 kilometers mirror in space, it would be much better if it could be a filled, complete surface. But if you can only afford, say, 100 pieces of 3 meters, then you use them as a dilute mosaic. Is that clear?
It is clear. And I guess what you're suggesting is that even though the mirrors are not able to capture all of the light within a 100 kilometer radius, because they're spread out over that area, they would have the resolving power of a telescope that large.
Yeah, that is the point.
Now, I imagine all of these widely separated pieces of the mosaic would have to work together. So how is it that the light they gather is combined to make that one sharp image?
This of course requires some accurate adjustments to align the images, or actually to superpose the images contributed by each of the mirrors. But that's not too difficult to do. We already do it on Earth with systems which are sort of embryonic versions of what I'm talking about, which have only a few elements. But it works, and in principle it's easier in space because there is no disturbance from the atmosphere.
I see. So if these mirrors are orbiting in space somewhere, you can take full advantage of the high resolution you'd get there. I'm still trying to picture how the telescope would operate and how all the light is brought together. Can you give me an idea of how that would work?
Just think of a giant telescope with a mask in front of it, so a piece of cardboard with holes in it in front of the telescope, and just look through that. Well, what's going to happen is that there will be narrow beams getting in through the holes, but all the beams will converge at the focal plane, and what you will get is superposed images from each hole, all superposed on your camera. What the interferometer does is exactly the same thing. It's like little pieces of a giant mirror, and all the images are directly superposed on the camera. And what happens is that the superposition of images provides interference patterns that create this high resolution.
I see. And how far away would the camera have to be from the mirrors?
Well, it would typically be a few hundred kilometers if the size of the dilute mirror is 100 kilometers.
Well, it seems like a remarkable proposition. All of those separately guided mirrors spaced out over such a large area, all feeding together a camera that's further away, all moving together in space. What kind of technology would be required to keep all of these elements in sync with each other?
Well, initially, the space agencies, you know, NASA, ESA, etc., thought that it was science fiction and it would never be possible to do it. But now they believe in it and they want to do it. Well, it's quite easy to have very accurate positioning of satellites relative to each other in space because there is no wind. There is little disturbance. All you need is accurate little rockets or ion thrusters that will push them gently. And you need a laser system to measure the positions, to measure the geometry. And in principle, you can probably adjust this geometry to be controlled and stable within microns.
I'd like to know more about what kind of astronomy you'd be able to do with that sort of instrument. We spoke briefly about looking for exo-Earths, for example. My understanding is that it's very difficult to make that kind of observation because you end up having to deal with the glare from the star that the planet is orbiting around. Wouldn't that still be a problem, even with a vast telescope like the one you've described?
Yeah, it is a very difficult problem, but now a number of possible solutions are emerging that will use fairly conventional telescopes in orbit, like a 3-meter telescopes in orbit, that in principle can be equipped with a system that is called a coronagraph that was invented 50 years ago, or I should say 60 years ago, to observe the solar corona, which is also a very weak feature, very difficult to see around the sun. And the same sort of techniques will essentially clean the image from stellate coming from the parent star of a planet and clean it enough that one will be able to see the planet. So that should work within 10 years on planets that will be seen as a single dot, not resolved. And then later, it should work in the same way with larger machines that will show some detail of the same planets.
And tell me what kind of detail you're talking about. If we could imagine a telescope like this working with all of the technical challenges overcome, what might we expect to see?
Well, if it's 10 light years away and if you've got 100 kilometers instrument, 100 kilometers diameter flotilla of mirrors, you will see continents and you will see, you know, places like the Amazon basin or the Congo basin, you will see green dots. And that, of course, will be helpful to look for life.
It's an exciting idea. Now, we already have 8 and 10-meter telescopes, and these days astronomers are talking about 30-meter telescopes. When you speak with your colleagues about a 100-kilometer telescope, how do they react to that idea?
Well, some like it, some believe it's science fiction. Well, those who are experienced in interferometry, which is the technique behind these projects, well, tend to believe that it's possible.
And just one last question, Dr. Laberie, since we're talking about science fiction, has it ever crossed your mind that maybe somewhere out there someone's already built this type of telescope and could be keeping an eye on us right now?
Well, that's quite possible, yes. of course, this we don't know.
But if so, I guess they'll be able to watch your progress. And of course, we'll be interested in following your progress as well. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Dr. Laberie.
Okay.
Dr. Antoine Laberie spoke to us this week from the Callern Observatory in the snow-covered southern Alps of France. But you don't have to search nearly so far to find out about the amazing ideas astronomers are developing for the telescopes of the future. You can read all about it in this week's edition of New Scientist.
Subscribe to New Scientist magazine, and every week you'll enjoy a comprehensive roundup of the latest science and technology news, along with a listing of the best science jobs from around the world. Subscribe today and you'll save 40% off our annual price and get unlimited free access to the entire content of NewScientist.com. To take advantage of this offer, just visit www.NewScientist.com/2504. That's NewScientist.com/2504 for the week's best ideas. Ideas delivered right to your door.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the February 25th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, The Big Thirst. It takes about a ton of water to grow a handful of coffee beans. No wonder Earth is running dry. Green Gold. If hydrogen is the fuel of the future, then farming algae could be the best way to make it. And the Big Easy. As New Orleans gears up for a post-Katrina Mardi Gras, we bring you a special report on the technical challenges the city must confront. All this, plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission control. Transmission concluded.